Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. These are the last few days of Women's Month. Well, shouldn't every month be Women's Month as well as Men's Month and Children's Month? I would like to start today's program with something I wrote, Equal Rights Amendment, with the amendment. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took more than a century after the inception of the United States for American women to gain the vote. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution will not stay dead. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982. The date the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men in 1776. The ERA failed, even though it had the support of 80% of the electorate, because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states that had initially approved the measure rescinded their votes. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The ERA has been sent to the grave more than once in the many, many, many years since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, and the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 53 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, the newly elected Congress, whichever, should resurrect the ERA as one of its first measures. It must once again travel the tortuously long trail through the states. 38 states must ratify it, and even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote out of office all who oppose it and support only candidates who endorse it, which, unfortunately, was not an issue in the past. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, "There shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth." And that was something I wrote. And now, by Alicia Haridasani Gupta, for the New York Times, "The Roadblocks to Equal Rights for Women a Century Later." And quote, "Just make us equal under the law." And that was by Representative Jackie Speier, Democrat of California. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday, March 17th, passed a bill that could clear the way for the nearly century-old Equal Rights Amendment to be added to the Constitution, providing equal protection under the law regardless of sex. The bill, which passed 222-204, almost entirely along party lines, is largely procedural. It removes a deadline for ratification that expired in the early 1980s. At the time, the amendment was not ratified by the constitutionally required 38 states, and it was left to linger for decades. But last year, on the heels of Nevada and Illinois, Virginia became the crucial 38th state to ratify it, reviving hopes among ERA supporters that it could finally become part of the Constitution. It is time for us to stop at the excuses. It is time to do what's right and make sure that women are in the Constitution, Representative Jackie Speier, Democrat of California and the bill's sponsor, said in a news conference after it passed in the House. She was flanked by other female House Democrats, all dressed in white, the color of the suffragists. Just make us equal under the law, she added. But the measure faces an uphill battle in the Senate, with backing from just a handful of Republicans. I wish that I could tell you that we had more Republican support, said Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, who is working to rally senators from her party around the measure. Hopefully, we will be able to get some traction over here, she added. The country has been here before. Last year, the House extended the deadline, but the bill failed to move in the Senate. And today, America remains one of the few countries in the world without any explicit guarantee of gender equality in its constitution, and several legal wrinkles, most importantly, whether Congress even has the power to remove the ratification deadline. Still, the amendment's adoption is far from guaranteed. But what is different this time is a renewed appreciation of the amendment's importance. And, of course, a Democratic-controlled Senate may help. Advocates say the pandemic, the economic crisis, and a right-leaning Supreme Court that may be a blocker for women's rights have highlighted just how vulnerable American women are. A whole generation of women thought they were protected and already equal, said Kate Kelly, a human rights lawyer and host of the podcast, Ordinary Equality. But COVID made visible inequities that to many were invisible before, she said. Now that inequality is laid bare, they can see the desperate need for a fundamental permanent solution. The text of the ERA, or what would be the 28th Amendment, is succinct. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. If implemented, activists and legal scholars expect that its effects could be sweeping, clearing the way for Congress to guarantee equal pay, for example, or bolster measures to counter domestic violence and sexual harassment. The amendment was first introduced in Congress in 1923, just a few years after women secured the right to vote. Nearly 50 years later, in 1972, Congress passed a version of the measure with broad bipartisan support. At that point, Congress set a deadline in the amendment's preamble, or introduction, for states to ratify it, originally 1979, which was later extended to 1982. Many states were quick to jump on board. Hawaii was the first, just 30 minutes after the Senate passed the amendment. And by the end of 1972, 21 other states had followed suit. But the initial momentum tapered out, in large part because of the self-proclaimed anti-feminist Phyllis Schlafly, who mounted a powerful opposition campaign that turned the bipartisan issue into a cultural lightning rod. She argued that the ERA would ruin traditional family structures, diminishing women's roles as homemakers and child rearers, and strip women of privileges like sex-segregated bathrooms. Later on, opponents also argued that the ERA could invalidate state-level abortion restrictions. By the 1982 deadline, 35 states had ratified the measure, leaving it three short of success. To bridge the gap, a crop of pioneering lawyers, most prominent among them the eventual Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, persuaded the Supreme Court, through a bevy of cases, to extend the 14th Amendment to cover sex discrimination, achieving in many ways what the ERA would have done. But that approach of tackling discriminatory laws one by one could only go so far. The reason proponents wanted the ERA was not only to get judges to strike down bad laws, but also to empower Congress to write new laws that would address the inequalities that women face in society because of their sex, said Julie Suk, author of We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment. In 1992, the 27th Amendment, an amendment pertaining to congressional pay was added to the Constitution 200 years after it was first introduced in Congress. For ERA supporters, it served as a eureka moment, planting a seed for the ideas of simply removing the ratification deadline from the 28th Amendment. There was a growing appreciation about, you know, what's the deadline all about anyway? Why do we have to live by the deadline? Ms. Speer said. If Congress made the deadline, Congress can change the deadline. Several legal scholars agree. Since the deadline is in the preamble, it may not even be legally binding, said Catherine Frank, a law professor at Columbia and faculty director of its ERA Project Research Initiative. She also noted that in the past, the Supreme Court has ruled that Congress has full control over the process of finalizing a constitutional amendment, which is how Congress already extended the ERA deadline once. After years of campaigning and a reignited interest in the wake of President Donald J. Trump's election and the Me Too movement, Nevada ratified the amendment in 2017. Then Illinois followed in 2018, and Virginia joined in 2020. Republicans who oppose the measure argue that there is no precedent for retroactively changing a deadline, as the House bill does, and that doing so could be unconstitutional. The Justice Department also issued a memo last year echoing that line of reasoning. Democrats are trying to turn back the clock, Representative Tom Cole, Republican of Oklahoma, said of the bill. This is a highly unusual step. Another potential twist is that since 1982, five states have rescinded their ratification. The question of whether that is allowed is still unanswered, though there is still some precedent. Three states rescinded their ratification of the 14th Amendment, but were still counted in the yes column when the amendment was adopted in 1868. Legal questions aside, the ERA remains hugely popular among voters. Almost 80% of Americans supported adding it to the Constitution in a Pew Research Center poll last year, and activists believe it is not a question of if, but when. It's in many respects an embarrassment that we don't have express sex equality protections, Ms. Frank said. The ERA provides an opportunity for a more modern approach to equality. I see it as a kind of modernizing tune-up of the Constitution that is way overdue. That was The Roadblock to Equal Rights for Women a Century Later by Alicia Haridasani Gupta and Emily Cochran contributed the reporting, and it was written for the New York Times. And now, something that I've written and have possibly read on this program before, Women's Equality Day. The major necessity of the 21st century is to achieve the political, social, and personal equality of women, which transcends every other pressing inequity, because it is the most basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill virtually everything else that needs to be done. Though we are a single species, our genders have separate stories. Fundamentally, one is of life, the other of death. Of persuasion and connection versus force and supremacy. The male gender is out of whack. So suffused with dominance and control, it is the major danger to the survival of the species and also to life on the planet. The leavening influence of women is most likely the real key to our future on the planet as a world society and thriving species. Women were, after all, the irrefutable pioneers of the cultivation of grains and domestication of animals that produced civilization in the first place. The deceit that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic throughout history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human yearning. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took half a century for American women to gain the right to vote after it was at long last allowed to be introduced to Congress in 1878, exactly 91 years after the U.S. Constitution was adopted. The nation has been saddled with the swagger of blustering maleness, despite a popular majority of women voters whose political endeavors are too often denied by fraud and corruption at virtually every level of male assertion of power. Women have contributed hugely to American history, but as with blacks and others who have helped build this nation, their contributions have been ignored or undervalued. The date, August 26th, was commemorated as Women's Equality Day in the USA because American women have had the vote for a century since August 26, 1920. The bitter fight for equal suffrage with men lasted three quarters of a century. Yet as the current reactionary, primarily right-wing, war against women indicates, it has not by any stretch lived up to its claim for equal rights. The fact that women voted for the first time in equal numbers as men in 1980 and have often since voted in greater numbers than men has not altered male dominance of political power. Although women generally vote differently than men, they do not necessarily vote for women. Yet election year 1992 was significant because women campaigned in unprecedented numbers for every conceivable office in the country, local, state, and federal, including at least one woman for president. Women entered politics backed by other women, finally using their majority power to elect women to public office. Eleanor Roosevelt was adamant, women must get into the political game and stay in it. In 1787, the new United States Constitution left the determination of who was eligible to vote to the states, but did not specifically bar women from holding federal office. States' rights meant then, as now, limited participation or none by those outside the white male status quo. New Jersey's state constitution gave the vote to all property owners worth a certain amount, which left wives as well as unmarried women ineligible. However, the state's election law was briefly revised in 1790 and referred to voters as he or she, quote unquote. New York specifically denied voting rights to women in its constitution in 1777, and other states quickly followed suit. Thomas Jefferson, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, said as president in response to a suggestion in 1807 by Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, "The appointment of a woman to office is an innovation for which the public is not prepared, nor am I." And that was Jefferson. The 19th century began with women voting in substantial numbers in the 1800 presidential election. But in 1807, New Jersey changed its election law once more by inserting the words white and male into its voting requirements, and women were not permitted to hold public office in any of the states. In the summer of 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, perhaps the most famous gathering of American women in the 19th century, was held in Seneca Falls, New York. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Martha Coffin Wright, Jane Hunt, and Mary Ann McClintock were the principal organizers and were surprised that almost 300 people, mostly women, attended. A declaration of sentiments was drafted by Stanton at the convention, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. It condemned women's disenfranchisement, their lack of a voice in the laws they were compelled to obey, restrictions on their education and employment opportunities, their subordination by the church, the use of a moral double standard, and the theft of married women's full property rights. The group then passed a series of general resolutions that called for women's equal rights. A proposal to secure the vote for women narrowly passed after arguments by Stanton and former slave and black abolitionist Frederick Douglass, but took more than 70 years to be fulfilled. Only one woman who signed the resolution, Charlotte Woodward, later Pierce, lived to cast her ballot. The Civil War, as it did every facet of American society, altered the structure and goals of the feminist movement, which began to concentrate primarily on women's suffrage as the process through which every other form of equity would be certified. In May 1866, men and women from the American Anti-Slavery Society and women's rights groups joined forces to form the American Equal Rights Association in New York. With Lucretia Mott as president and Susan B. Anthony as corresponding secretary, the group began a campaign for suffrage for all African Americans and all women. Thousands of women signed a petition drafted by Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton that demanded Congress initiate a constitutional amendment to, quote, prohibit the several states from disenfranchising any of their citizens on the grounds of sex, unquote. Congress passed the 14th Amendment in 1866 and was ratified in 1868. It stated that all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens and guaranteed due process and equal protection under the law. However, another section referred to voting rights in the terms of male citizens, the first time this qualification appeared in the Constitution. Elizabeth Cady Stanton ran for Congress that year, though she was not allowed to vote, and although she received only 24 votes of 12,000 cast, she proved women had the right to campaign for public office. Stanton and Anthony formed the National Women's Suffrage Association to push for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the vote in 1869. Later that year, Lucy Stone, Julia Ward Howe, and others established a countergroup, the American Women's Suffrage Association. The two groups were rivals for 20 years. The NWSA was generally the more radical, advocating not just the vote, but also reforms in women's wages, working conditions, and property and divorce laws. The AWSA focused on women's suffrage, working at the state rather than federal level. In December 1869, Wyoming Territory granted women's suffrage in its new constitution. The legislature also guaranteed married women rights to their own property and approved equal pay for male and female teachers. The following year, Utah Territory gave the vote to women, took it away in 1887, and restored it in 1896. Colorado's women got the vote in 1893 after prominent local socialites joined the state's suffrage movement. By 1896, four contiguous states, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah, had full suffrage, but no other state would for 14 more years. And the other reforms are still on the table, awaiting reform: women's wages, working conditions, etc. That was something I wrote, Women's Equality Day. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser-Schalk is engineer for this program. Yesterday was Helen Taddy Hill's birthday. Perhaps most of you who don't know, or those who have possibly forgotten, Helen purchased and donated the beautiful old Tillicum House uphill from the downtown Astoria riverfront to KMUN for its radio residence in 1987. Helen is also principally responsible for Oregon's open adoption law. Everyone has the right to know who they are, she said at the time of a bitter but triumphant initiative election campaign to allow adoptees disclosure of their genealogies. KMUN is amidst its spring and anniversary pledge drive, and I express my appreciation to the good sense of you old and new members who have pledged to KMUN, the North Oregon Coast independent radio station. Free radio isn't free. Encourage everyone to pledge and join KMUN. Springtime is not going to vanish the plague. Lock down and mask up as usual and get vaccinated. For the brighter days, we hope come around again. Remember, keeping yourself safe makes life safer for everyone else.